You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at noon, join us to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Live from the Capitol Rotunda, it's Wisconsin's 42nd annual tribute and ceremony. With words and music, it's the nation's oldest official MLK State commemoration. Tune in Monday at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, are you a worrier? Do you worry? Maybe a lot. Does it keep you awake or distract you? Could be something big and serious or something smaller that we get fixated on. Either way, worrying can be something to worry about. Help is on the way. Our next guest is a psychology expert who says we may not be able to stop worrying, but we can do it better, more productively, and in ways that give us less stress. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem for you? When does worrying affect you the most? Have you found some solutions of your own? Hey, do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tracy Dennis-Tawari is an anxiety researcher and founder of Wise Therapeutics. She's a psychology and neuroscience professor at Hunter College in New York, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She wrote about worrying in the Washington Post. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with some of the basics. What really is worrying and how does it relate to anxiety?
Well, you can think of worry as the thinking part of anxiety. So it's the thoughts that go in, you know, through our head as we're feeling anxiety. It actually gives, in some ways, it gives focus to those anxious feelings because it's we sort of become mental time travelers into the future when we worry. We're imagining what might be coming around the bend. We're kind of doing this form of problem solving, really, where we're saying, ooh, what if this thing happens? What do we do? What are the bad outcomes that are possible? And what can we do to make the best outcomes come to be?
In that Washington Post piece, you share a personal example of something where, gosh, if I were you, I would have been worried too. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and how it inspired your ways to deal with worry?
Yes, that was when I was pregnant with my first child, my son, Covey. And we found out in the middle of my pregnancy that he was going to be born with a congenital heart condition that would require open heart surgery when he was, you know, would still be an infant. And so we knew this was reality. We knew that in that sense, my husband and I, that it was something out of our control. The diagnosis had been made. And so now worry was really my constant companion because everything day to day was me thinking about, you know, what would happen when he's born? How can we prepare for this eventuality and any challenges we might face?
Now, stepping back from that for a bit, as you were saying earlier, worry can be good. It can serve some practical purposes. How can we tell when worrying is too much? When whether it's a big problem like that or maybe something small that I've blown out of proportion, when do we see worry become a problem that we want to try to strategize about?
Right. I think that before we figure out whether it's a problem, we have to tune in to what worry is telling us. So like all difficult emotions, worry and anxiety, this is giving us information and preparation. So when I was worried, for example, about my son, his heart condition, of course, the information is that there's this potentially life-threatening situation. But in that information, I'm also projecting myself into a future where I know he can still survive and thrive. I know that it's not a death sentence necessarily, and so there's something I can do about it. And so now that anxiety and that worry is actually focusing me and preparing me to take steps now that I can, of what's in my control, and you know some things are not in my control, but taking those steps to prepare for his birth, to do the research, find the right doctor. So, you know, this is uncomfortable. It's extremely distressing, and we've all experienced this firsthand. But when we can use that worry as information, you know, use it to problem solve and take steps in the future, you know, then it's still in this realm of healthy and normal worrying. And indeed, knowing that it's healthy allows us to really leverage it, you know, to take it as information and preparation. Now, to your question, when do we start to see that it is becoming a problem? One thing that can happen is that when we get so caught up in our worries, we start to worry about our worry. This is actually called meta-worry, where we fear that worry is so out of control, it's so overwhelming and constant that it's damaging to us or dangerous, and we won't be able to let go of it. And unfortunately, that fear of worry can actually spiral anxiety and worry even more out of control. So it becomes a vicious cycle. So if you find yourself having worries that seem to spiral and spiral and you're not sure how to let go of them, that can be a sign that worry is starting to get in your way.
Now, before we get into some worrying strategies, I don't want to leave our listeners worrying here. Your son, things came out pretty good, right?
Yeah, thank you. No, I wanted to make sure to put that in the story. I appreciate that. Yes, my son is now 14 years old. He did have open heart surgery when he was 4 months old, but we were so blessed. We had wonderful surgeons, wonderful healthcare providers, and now he loves doing things like playing the piano, running, wrestling, writing, and our doctors told us, we don't have to worry about his health. We just have to, get his regular checkup. So, I do want to say one thing quickly about that. Sometimes, because worry is sort of this attempt to predict and control the future, we're trying to do anything we can to take care of ourselves and our loved ones. Of course, sometimes it doesn't work out. Someone wrote in to me with this article that they had a situation where they had a loved one where the story wasn't as happy as it was for my son. So, I think when we think about whether worry is helpful or when it gets in our way, we do have to acknowledge that it gives us a sense of control, but there are things in life we can't control, and we just have to do our best to leverage worry to take whatever steps we can in this uncertain world we live in.
We're talking about worrying and how to work with our sense of worry with Tracy Dennis-Tawari, an anxiety researcher, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. Well, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a point in your life where you felt like you worried too much, where it was interfering with your daily life, your sleeping life? Did you find ways around that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into some of the advice you share in that piece. First of all, there are good steps to take. One of the steps, though, not to take, trying to avoid or block or stop worrying. That sounds like a good solution to me. Why is that not helpful, though?
Well, it's definitely what we feel primed to do because worry has to feel unpleasant to do its job. It's painful. It has to grab our attention so that we focus on the future and take whatever preparatory steps we can. I mean, remember, anxiety, worry, these are feelings we evolved to have. And it is a double-edged sword, but like anything we try to suppress, even anything as simple as don't think of a white bear. Of course, the first thing that's going to pop into our mind is a big picture of a white polar bear, probably. So anytime we try to suppress thoughts, especially when we try to suppress emotions, they always come back stronger than before. And there's good research to show this is the case. So if worry isn't going anywhere, if it's the human condition, and that if we can sometimes use it to our advantage, we do have to come up with solutions that aren't suppression and avoidance because they simply don't work. And so the first thing we need to do is to tune into our worries and allow ourselves to experience them so that we can start to see what information they're telling us.
And then that next step you have in your piece is, I think of worrying all in my head. You say we want to locate the worry in our body.
And that's the best way to start tuning into it. So maybe, I don't know if this ever happens to you, Rob, but I wake up sometimes at 4 a.m. with worries going through my head.
Oh, yeah.
And so, of course, what we want to do is make them go away. But here's an opportunity. But before we can really understand what this, maybe it's a swirl, kind of a miasma of thoughts in our head. We're not sure what we're even worrying about. Sometimes worry disconnects us from the feelings in our body because we get stuck in our head. So just taking time to pause. Maybe you are lying in bed worrying. You want to take a breath. You feel your heart beating faster. You start to tune into what are these feelings I'm having? Am I stiff? Am I holding myself tightly? Am I breathing rapidly? As soon as we start tuning in to those feelings, that the tension starts to unwind. We start to maybe realize that, if I sit or I stretch or I just breathe, we practice riding those feelings, they start to dissipate. We also, when we give space to those feelings in our body, we often find that whatever we're worrying about, it kind of rises to the surface. So we start to realize, this is the thought that's in my head. This is what's on my mind as I sort of have this yucky set of feelings that I'm trying to make sense of.
Anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tawari is with us to help us manage our worrying about things big and small. She says We can't necessarily worry less, but we can worry better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you feel like you worry a lot? Does it get in the way of your daily life, keep you awake at night? Have you found some ways to take it head on, do something with it, get over it after you work with it a little bit? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take the next steps on managing our worry coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tawari, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She's sharing advice to help us manage our worrying. She wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post a few days back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? If you're willing to share your story dealing with maybe chronic worrying or a point in your life where it was a problem for you, if you found ways to deal with it, if you have a question for our guest, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's pick up where we left off. Tracy, we've located the worry. We've seen how it's affecting us physically, the heartbeat, and so on. Your next step is to make worry concrete and contained. How do we do that?
Right. This is what some listeners may know of as name it to tame it. This is really about making our worries clear, giving them words. You know, often the worst part of worry is that we just have a jumble of thoughts and we're not sure what we're feeling. So just giving that time to, you know, treat yourself like a friend who needs you to lend them an ear. Really just allow your worries to come and don't judge them and don't push them away. Sometimes it really helps as you're sorting through any worries you might have. Pick a specific period of time to worry, especially if you feel like you're having a lot of worries. Write them all down. Give them words, but limit the time you're allowing yourself to worry. Say 15 minutes. You write down anything that comes into your head. Describe the details of the worry, what you think are the bad things that could happen. Also, what are the good possibilities that you want to make happen? Picture what you're actually worrying about, not just worrying about, oh, I don't want this thing to happen. I don't want to, I have this job interview coming up and I'm just feeling worried about it. No, actually picture, I'm worried that when I go into the job interview, I might not know what to say. Also, you could picture yourself actually solving that problem in the moment. So you just want to get very concrete. When I go to that job interview, I might have a moment when I don't know what to say, but then I'm going to remind myself of those two or three sentences that I memorized to start out the interview with. So here's where you can start to own these worries instead of letting them own you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bevan is with us in Madison. Bevan, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say that in 30 years of Zen practice, also now today known as mindfulness, worrying is not something to be avoided or something you should feel bad about. It's actually a survival mechanism. And the point is not to avoid worrying, but to learn how to do it right. Because parents or anyone who worries properly will be worrying about the right things and how to basically manage that. So if you don't set aside time for worrying every day, and this is what a lot of meditation is spent in worrying, and then you get that done, and it's over with. So that's about it.
Bevan, thanks a lot for that call. And Tracy, that you had mentioned that the idea of scheduling worrying, does that work if it's 5 o'clock and I'm like having that worry and I'm like, no, I've got worry penciled in for 8 o'clock. Does that really help people?
It's amazing what usually happens for people. It does help many, many people. And what starts to happen when you give yourself this 15 minutes is you start to lose steam. You're like, oh, wait a second. you know, this worry that started feeling out of control, all of a sudden when you force yourself to worry for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, it loses its hold on you. And you've made these less frightening, these worries. You've made them concrete. And you've started to prime yourself, prepare yourself to come up with some solutions.
Bevan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And then you just mentioned solving the solutions we can come up with. How can we turn that sort of miasma of worrying into a problem-solving exercise?
Right. And really, this is the way we are approaching our worries, this is the way that we would approach any sort of problem solving in our lives. So it's, again, it normalizes, and as Bevan mentioned, you know, worry is a normal part of life. So rather than feeling that we're broken and worry is so damaging and destructive, really we can reframe our mindset to say, well, worry is a part of life, but I can use it to my advantage. I can gain skills in using it to problem solve. And so once you have tuned into your bodily feelings, you've tuned into your thoughts and given them words, you can start to problem solve in steps. So first, you can start by brainstorming solutions. You know, all ideas are good ideas. Remembering that we do have to think about things that are in our control and maybe considering that some things are not in our control. Even in the case of my son, when he was diagnosed with a heart condition, that is out of my control that he had this condition. But what's in my control is that I can learn about the best doctors in my area. I can learn about what to expect and prepare kind of the ground, so to speak, for when he will be born. What do we need in place so that he can have the best outcome possible and the best support and health care? So brainstorm solutions that are in your control. Then, like any sort of brainstorm, evaluate the pros and cons. You can, you know, type this up, take a pad and a sharp pencil, go through these steps with your worries. Take some time, think through the ideas, and then once you've evaluated pros and cons, you know, select one or two solutions that you can pursue. And then, staying concrete, make a solid plan to try out one or more of these solutions. And again, the more detail you write down, the better. With any problem solving, any, you know, habit changes that we might want to make, starting small, starting with doable steps one at a time, break it down into things that you can actually do. When my son was sick, I knew that I wanted to do everything I could to ensure that he was okay. And that's a big goal, so I broke that down into smaller goals. I started by finding the right doctor. I did some research on the condition. I learned, you know, so I broke it down into these bite-sized pieces. I tried out some of these solutions, so that's the next step. Once we identify the plan and have doable steps, try out those solutions and then evaluate how does it work. And then from there, you can consider whether adjustments and additional problem solving is needed. So these worries that can be this miasma, this really unpleasant, overwhelming feeling, we're breaking that down into steps that we can actually take in our life.
We're talking about worrying with Tracy Dennis-Tawari, anxiety researcher, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Yeah, I wonder, it's a little bit like something my dad said a lot when he was alive, and he was a praying man, and he was not a fundamentalist type, but kind of devout, and he would say, okay, we'll pray now, and sometimes he'd even get on his knees and pray, which used to embarrass me, but it doesn't now. But he would say, okay, we'll lay these prayers out before the Lord, but he said, before we get up, we're going to take them all back.
Lay the fears out before the Lord and then take them back. Randy, thank you for sharing that. Tracy, I mean, whether
that's
writing
beautiful.
It down on a piece of paper or meditating or praying, the same principle seems to apply.
I love that. And it just goes to show that, you know, we have these tools in our toolkit, whether it's faith, religious faith, whether it's health practice, whether it's journaling, whether it's just being able to find 5 or 10 minutes and sitting quietly. You know, these are things that we can do. And what I love about that suggestion of sort of laying it out is it's also acknowledging that there are some things we can control, there's some things we can't. There also has to be a level of acceptance. And, you know, the more you fight worries, the more they tend to accelerate and sort of feel out of control. And so there is a level here of accepting the messy work of being human. And so that's part of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Gina is with us in Appleton now. Gina, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Gina, or bring up?
So just in listening to it, I just thought this was really interesting. I'm driving home after my day of work, and I've had a lifetime of like different levels of kind of worry that I've sorted through, and wondered, you know, is there a way to even really manage it? So it was really interesting to hear this today, because I might just pick up the book and
just
and
a
read
quick
that,
question, but, Gina. We're just about out of time.
Yeah. So what my question is there advocacy and kind of support for individuals that are like at a younger age, maybe?
Gotcha. Gina, thanks for the call. Tracy, we just have a minute or so left. Advice for helping young kids deal with worry.
I'd say all of these tools are the same, and kids especially, we can, you know, help them name it to tame it. We can help them give words to their worries, let them know that it's manageable, let them know that we're there to support them, and then help them let go, which is the final step, that once we've visited the future, made some plans, allowed ourselves to worry, we can come back to the present, and we can do that through prayer, through exercise, a journal, talking to a therapist, talking to a friend. We can also let go of these worries once we've used them as information and preparation.
Gina, thanks for the call. And Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was great speaking with you and your callers.
That was anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tiwari, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You Even Though It Feels Bad. She joined us to help manage our worrying. There's still time for you to share your suggestions. Maybe you have advice, maybe a lesson you learned along the way on dealing with your worries and cares throughout your life. Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org or post, share them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, let's boost our happiness for 2023. We'll get started with a 7-day happiness project where a lot of different little things can add up to a big difference to hopefully make us a little bit happier in the new year. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to make some great salads with a self-described salad freak. We'll get some recipes and advice to make sure we never have another boring salad. I can use that. I love salads when somebody else makes them for me. I feel like I make really boring, uninteresting salads. So I'm looking forward to that. That and more coming up. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, cash bail reform is a big priority for Wisconsin's legislature to start this new year. Their proposal to amend the state constitution appears to be heading for voter approval on the April ballot. We'll get the details and ask if it will all make us any safer. First, dairy farmers around the state have been struggling to make ends meet for decades. Things may have improved a bit for a couple years, but dairy farm closures hit a 3-year high last year. Big picture, since the year 2000, more than 70% of dairy farms in Wisconsin have closed down. With the cost of feed going up lately, some dairy farmers are looking for emergency assistance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone you know is a dairy farmer, how are things going? If you've closed a dairy farm in the last 5, 10, 20 years, like to hear your story as well. Do you have questions about what's going on in the dairy business in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
5 years ago, we were having conversations about dairy farmers, and the story, a big part of the story then, was low milk prices. It seems like things are different. There's a different set of problems now.
That's right. Right now, it's a kind of a return to a long-term trend, and I think what's accelerating it right now is accelerating costs, as you kind of mentioned in your opening comments, things like feed cost, diesel costs, just kind of the day-to-day operational costs. It's just gotten to a point that a lot of dairy farmers are saying, you know, I've been looking at retirement, and there's nobody coming in behind me, so it's time to shut it down.
And we've talked in the past as well about the size of farms and who's being hit. What are the latest trends as far as the size of farms that are leaving the business?
We're still seeing it kind of in what you would refer to as kind of your middle size or average size farm. As we've talked before, there's kind of this what's called a bifurcation. We're seeing growth at the smaller size where they can kind of keep their operating costs down and growth at the larger farms. It's those farms that are like 150 cows, up to 200 cows. Those are the ones that are really having a difficult time making a go of it.
And those smaller ones, again, we've talked about this before, I think it isn't necessarily that the dairy business is so good that they're, you know, selling milk like hotcakes there. It's they're doing some other kind of work.
That's right. the last time we talked, we were talking about the kind of the role of off-farm income for the farm family, the farm household. And for a lot of the smaller scale operations, that off-farm, there's two things. One is that off-farm income is allowing the family to survive, the household to survive. And the smaller scale allows the farmers to keep their costs down. So, for example, grazing is one way. So you can kind of see this opportunity at the smaller scale, but the ones that are in the middle, they're the ones that are they're getting squeezed.
The number of dairy farms going down in Wisconsin keeps going down. How about our overall milk production in the state?
Milk production has actually gone up a little bit because if you look at the number of cows, that's actually fairly stable. It fluctuates up and down a little bit, but over the long term, it's relatively stable. So what's happening is when these farmers, these medium-sized, average-sized farmers, dairy farmers are leaving, is they're selling the cattle off to larger operations. So the amount of cows that we have operating is basically remaining the same, and the productivity of those cows is going up. So the actual volume of milk that's being produced is actually going up.
So people might hear that and say, okay, it's sad for a farm who's a family who's leaving their farm now, but if our production is about the same number of cows, does that really impact our communities, our overall economy? It's just, you know, the same amount of milk on different size farms.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is kind of the culture and the history of Wisconsin and what we kind of think of as ourselves. So there's kind of a cultural dimension there. It's kind of our identity. So there's that to think about. But I think the other side is a lot of these large CAFO operations, there's concerns with environmental issues, regulatory management type issues with these. So while we're still seeing milk production at a good level, we're kind of trading off one set of issues for another set of issues.
We're talking about the challenges facing dairy farming, a different set of challenges, but still there here in Wisconsin. Steve Deller is with us with UW Extension and UW Madison, professor in agricultural and applied economics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about maybe your own farm or your family's farm, what you're seeing in your community, if you have questions for our guest, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Getting back to the numbers of dairy farm closures in the states, Steve, 2019, really bad. I think over 800 farm closures. Last year, 400. There'd been a dip in the intervening couple of years. What was going on there?
Well, there were two things that happened. One is that through COVID and the federal stimulus money, there was a significant amount of money that flowed to farmers, not only out of the COVID stimulus money, but also remember that when President Trump, former President Trump, started the trade negotiations with China, there was, you know, farmers were at risk because of that negotiation, those negotiations with China. And former President Trump injected a lot of money into the farm economy there. So there was that coming in. Then there was COVID and the injection of money from the Biden administration. And then there's also this other thing is that there is a moratorium on foreclosures. So a lot of banks kind of backed off a little bit and essentially gave farmers and dairy farmers a little bit of breathing room. Well, that stimulus money's gone. And now the moratorium on foreclosures is gone. So banks are starting to come back in again. So you can almost think of it as like a stream where there's water running through the stream. And that's water running is farms leaving, dairy farms leaving. If you put a temporary dam in there or you blocked up the stream temporarily, that flow would go down. But as soon as you take that temporary dam out, there's a surge of water. And that's, I think, what we're seeing right now is there's a surge in the number of dairy farms that are deciding to call it quits.
Now, let's dig into another point you mentioned earlier, the cost of inputs, especially feed. Inflation in general driving up costs for a lot of things. When it comes to the stuff that farmers are buying to feed their cows, what is driving prices there?
It's Ukraine. Ukraine is a major producer of grains. And grains is the primary source of feed for cows and all livestock. So when the Ukrainian war flared up and a lot of the exports out of Ukraine were cut off, that caused, you know, real strong ripples through the grain markets. And that's falling back onto dairy farmers and beef farmers and other types of livestock farmers in the terms of very high feed costs.
You mentioned beef farming. I read in the Journal Sentinel that one factor that's in here is if I'm thinking someday I'm going to have to sell my herd, right now is a pretty good time to do it because the price that I could sell those cows for is pretty high right now.
That's right. That's because we are coming off high milk prices. So you're seeing a number of larger dairy operations that are thinking about how can they expand. Not expand in terms of doubling their size, but, you know, significant kind of marginal increases. So now's a good time to be doing it. If the cost of feed and the cost of diesel and fuels continue to stay high and the price of milk starts to come down, I think you're going to see that that market for buying those cows start to taper off a little bit. So from a purely business perspective, now if a dairy farmer is looking at retirement, they're looking at getting out, now's a pretty good time to do it.
A big issue seems to be not just that, hey, prices are high here and prices are low here, but that they're volatile. They go up and down.
Yes.
And if I'm a farmer getting a market signal, dairy prices are high, I can't just turn the pump on. It takes time to expand production. By the time I've done that, maybe prices have gone down. I'm getting signals to lower production, and that takes time to do.
That's right. This is something, I mean, farmers have kind of ingrained this instability in commodity prices. I mean, they're kind of used to that. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of looking at, I mean, if they're making a decision, if I'm a dairy farmer and I'm saying, no, should I get out now? Should I get out a year from now? Should I get out 2 years from now? They're looking at these prices right now. And they're probably saying now's a good time. Who knows what next year is going to be?
Talking to Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. We are looking at dairy farms in Wisconsin. After years of declining numbers of farms, last year saw the biggest number of dairy farm closures since 2019, which was a pretty bad year when it comes to farm closures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If we're talking about you or your family's history, if you're willing to share your story, we would love to hear from you and the economic issues you're facing, the difficulties if you did decide to close a dairy farm. As a consumer, what questions do you have about the dairy business here in Wisconsin, what it means for the price of milk and other dairy products you count on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Deller, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, looking at losses in the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, leading some dairies across the state to close, others to seek emergency assistance amid high feed prices. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how inflation, about how costs are affecting farmers, the long-term trends in the price of milk? If we're talking about you and your own life story, your own livelihood, love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We heard Steve from Deborah in Madison who called, couldn't stay on the air. Deborah asks, why don't more farmers have grass and alfalfa-fed cattle rather than having grains imported from around the country and from overseas?
It depends on whether or not the farmer has the land to do it. It also depends on the size of the farm. If you're more of a modest-sized farmer, dairy farmer, and you have the land, you can do that. And we're seeing growth in the number of dairy farmers that are taking that strategy. But if you're kind of landlocked and you don't have a whole lot of land around you, or that land is being used for crop production, it's really not an option for you. Or if you're above a certain size, the mechanics of it doesn't start to make sense above a certain size.
Thanks for that question, Deborah, at 800-642-1234. One thing we haven't got into, Steve, is a lot of businesses affected by this, the cost of labor. What are we seeing on dairy farms?
I think that's another factor that is, you know, there's a lot of things. We talked about, you know, the price of diesel, for example, or the price of feed, for example. I think it's also labor. A lot of these types of farms, you need to be able to hire off-farm labor to come in and help operate the farm. And that's just becoming unavailable. You simply cannot find it. Or you have to pay such a high wage rate that it doesn't make economic sense for you. So it's almost like it's not one particular thing that's driving this. It's an accumulation of a bunch of things. And I think that the shortage of labor is kind of moving up that list a little bit.
I've mentioned a couple times the idea of some emergency assistance with high feed costs. I think Senator Tammy Baldwin has at least floated the notion. Is that something you expect to see happen that is needed right now?
Probably. This is something that the federal government and USDA, there's almost always, when farmers are, their back is against the wall, there's almost always federal support coming out to help them. And I wouldn't be surprised if that happens now, but it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on something that's hemorrhaging. It's almost delaying the inevitable. If this was a short-term spike in feed cost, you know, I could see maybe, but we don't know if these kind of higher prices, how long these things are going to be around.
Talking about dairy farming and the business here in Wisconsin, Steve Deller is with us from UW-Madison. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard, a lot of the mid-sized dairy farms closing, bigger ones getting bigger, some smaller ones out there. Does it matter to you how big dairy farms are here in the state? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve, I hear sometimes from callers, not right now, but in the past, like that there's an unlevel playing field, that the deck is stacked maybe unfairly in favor of larger operations. I mean, is that just economies of scale and the market, or is there something more to it?
It's purely market forces at play. This is the way the capitalist system is set up, and there are favors to larger scale operations. They capture economies of scale. They also, because they're bigger, they can benefit from hiring professional management. They can benefit from hiring professional accountants. All the types of things that make for a bigger business more efficient, if you will, and more profitable, if you will, than, say, necessarily a smaller business. So, but this is true whether you're talking, you know, farms, or whether you're talking car dealerships, or you're talking, you know, entertainment venues. This is kind of the capitalist system, the market economy at work.
If I'm running a small or involved in a small local rural community, small town, are things different if I have a bunch of small to mid-sized dairy farms in my boundaries versus one big CAFO-type dairy farm?
From a purely local community's perspective, you would be better off having one large farm that is paying good wages than have a lot of small farms that are basically poverty level. That's kind of, that may come across as kind of blunt, but from a purely economic perspective, you're better off with fewer jobs paying better than a lot of jobs that don't pay very well at all.
Do those large-scale farm jobs pay in that way?
They have the potential to. Now, if they do or not, that's different. I mean, you know, we talk about large farms as kind of this homogeneous group, and there's a lot of heterogeneity in these farms, just like any kind of business. You have some large dairy farms that are, you know, excellent employers. They treat their employees fabulously. And then you have others that, you know, not so much. So, you know, we need to be careful about making broad generalizations here. But the bigger farms have the scale to be more profitable and kind of ride out rough times much more so than the smaller farms.
Let's move along the supply chain here. You've said on the show in the past, we think of, you know, the actual production, the dairy farm in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is big on food processing, what we do with those commodities and add value to them. What is that kind of business looking like from blocks of cheese to cheese on pizza and more?
We're seeing a bifurcation of the market. And one way to think about it is commodities. These are things like cheddar cheese that you buy for a frozen pizza. Okay. Cheddar cheese is cheddar cheese. You want to get the best price that you possibly can. That's one market. There's a lot of growth in that market, and that's the bigger side of the market, frozen pizzas, things like that. But there's another market that is more of a product-type market. This is specialty cheeses. And that market is also growing. So it's very, very different markets. Now, I think one of the things that's happening is a lot of the bigger farmers are kind of contracting with those commodity producers. It's going into, you know, mozzarella cheese that's going on Tombstone Pizza. There it's volume, volume, volume. Pennies, margins of pennies. But when you get into the organic or you get into the specialty foods, there that margin's a little bit bigger. And you can get by on a smaller volume.
So do we see smaller, people use the word boutique, but smaller dairy farms saying, yeah, I am supplying these fancy cheese makers. They don't need a huge volume, and this works out for both of us?
That's where a lot of the grazers are going. The smaller scales are contracting with these local artisan cheese plants, and the volume is there. And these specialty cheese plants are willing to pay a premium for cows that have been grazing on a certain type of grass. These artisan cheesemakers can tell the difference in terms of this cow's been grazing on this type of grass or it's been grazing on this other type of grass. And I can't tell the difference, but they can, and a big part of their market can. So that market, I think, is a potential for some of these farms, but it's a different type of market.
And it's a different type of farming. It's not something you could just jump into on any plot of land, right?
Exactly, because, you know, the way that you set up your farm, the way you operate your farm, the feed that you give your cattle, you know, the specialty cheesemakers are all interested in what you're feeding the cows, how are you treating the cows, and that's why these smaller scale farmers, they can fit into that. The bigger scale farmers, no, that's not their market.
In our last minute or so, Steve, what are you watching for in dairy in Wisconsin in 2023?
I'm hoping to see better policies for young farmers getting into dairy. I think part of the problem that we've got is that the number of young farmers that are interested in dairy is getting thinner and thinner and thinner. I think part of the problem is that the cost, if you're 33 years old and you need $1 million to buy into a small dairy farm, what banker is going to give that person a $1 million loan? They're not. Or it will be so astronomically expensive in terms of interest rates that it just doesn't make sense. So I think we need to kind of revisit the policies that we have in place. Wisconsin's been pretty aggressive on young dairy farmers, beginning farmers. I think we need to revisit what's working, what's not working.
Sounds like another great conversation, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about why some dairy farmers are facing trouble, a large number of closures in dairy farms in Wisconsin last year. Coming up after the news, we'll check out the state legislature's proposal for a constitutional amendment that would reform Wisconsin's cash bail system. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow here on Central Time.